The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. An attack in Central Europe today. Three separate bombings. The target was Brussels. People streaming from transportation hubs, the airport and railway station. The smoke from the bombings drifting through the headquarters of the European Union. The airport was a scene of chaos inside. The city in lockdown. Its terror alert, the highest ever, level 4. Malbec metro station, one of the targeted hubs located close to EU buildings, is also near a neighborhood known to be heavily Muslim, with numerous suspects and investigations of Islamic radicalism going back many, many years. Today, Belgian troops are patrolling the streets. Cell phone networks are jammed as users are urged not to call and text. And security has been beefed up at Belgian nuclear plants across Europe and even considerations in the United States. Security has been stepped up after French President François Hollande has called this an attack on the whole of Europe. There have been hundreds injured and at least 24 killed at this point. President Obama spoke about the attacks earlier today from Havana, Cuba.
We will do whatever is necessary to support our friend and ally Belgium in bringing to justice those who are responsible. And this is yet another reminder that the world must unite. We must be together. Regardless of nationality or race or faith, in fighting against the scourge of terrorism, we can and we will defeat those who threaten the safety and security of people all around the world.
Jan-Philipp Albrecht is a member of the European Parliament and vice chair of the Civil Liberties and Home Affairs Committee. He described how this very alarming day began for him.
I was going to the European Parliament office this morning at about 8 o'clock, and I was looking to my Twitter account and was informed about the attacks to the Brussels airport, which of course shocks everybody, especially at such a morning, because we know that members of the European Parliament, for example, or others are just arriving at that time at the Brussels airport, normally in such a sitting week. And also, just 1 hour later or half an hour later, we heard about the blast at the metro station, which is right 100 meter, 200 meter next to the European Parliament, where many people arrived to get to work in the morning. So it was really a shocking moment.
And you could see the smoke and the exodus taking place from the railway station.
Actually, we didn't see the smoke directly, but later on, it was clearly visible and people were just getting off that area. And we heard all the sirens of the police and soldiers being deployed around. And of course, people really trying to get in wherever they can get in, because everybody didn't really knew what was going on and what was perhaps happening still.
Were you confused about whether to stay in place in the building or evacuate?
Actually, I was already in the building of the European Parliament, and it was completely locked down immediately after the knowledge of these attacks. So since then, we get communications to either stay in the offices of all the EU institutions or go home immediately if we are outside and stay there, because the situation is still not resolved and there's still the highest security alert in the whole city of Brussels.
Brussels, of course, has been a crossroads of Europe for hundreds of years. It's certainly the case that this would be one of the most tragic examples of what that actually means.
It is clearly a tragic moment. It's also a moment in which we have to learn very clearly that the different national systems in place, security, police, intelligence in Europe, didn't cooperate that closely that it was possible to also get track of those terrorists. And I think we need to learn about being together better in Europe also on those matters.
You know, in many of the crises financially in Europe, the discussion has always been you can't have financial reality or rationality without stronger central governance in Europe. it would seem that attacks like this suddenly change that argument and make it essential that there be some sort of centralized security governance in any case.
It's certainly the case, and it's not new. We are having this debate latest since last year, where there have been these two very severe attacks in Paris, where we learned that it's not possible anymore to just draw some inner European borders and then think that you're safe still. So we need to talk about stronger EU governance in this area. But we also need to talk to not repeat mistakes. I think it's important that we are safeguarding democracy, rule of law, and civil liberties also in these dark times of huge security threats, and that we work with the tools we have to get track the best of those terrorists.
Jean-Philippe Albrecht, what is the inner threat as you see it right now, and as the EU sees it, and as the Belgians see it? And really, some have described this as an attack on Europe. How does Europe see this internal threat?
I really think that most of the Europeans realize that the threat is the weakness of security authorities in Europe not cooperating enough to get track of these people, because we don't it's not that we don't have information about these people. In most of the cases in recent attacks, let it be also in Brussels, in Paris, in Toulouse, in Copenhagen, there have been known suspects to most security authorities, but information haven't been followed up, information haven't been exchanged properly. So we need to work intensively on improving that. And then talking about also the sources and the origins of such a threat. And that is, of course, also to learn that many of these terrorists have been jailed in prisons, radicalized there, have been nationals of European states. So we need to talk about the sources of those radicalization.
I can well imagine Le Pen in France and some of the nationalist politicians in Germany calling immediately for deportations and expulsions. What's your answer to that?
I really think that we need to distinguish between those terrorists coming here or being here even already as nationals, trying to disrupt rule of law, democracy, freedom, to attack our values, and those who are fleeing, for example, from Syria, from exactly these terrorists going on, the Islamic State or so-called Islamic State, trying to attack not only our values, but also their lives. And we need to distinguish and make clear that we are open to each and everyone who is with us in a free, liberal society, staying to our values and defending them and tracking these terrorists who want to overcome it. And that is the most important task. And we shouldn't hear to those populists too much who are trying to connect the dots in a way which is completely arbitrary and wrong.
Finally, if this turns out to be a declared retaliatory attack against the arrest of the suspect in the Paris bombing, If that's the case, if this definitely follows that arrest, then ISIS appears to have demonstrated, or whoever's behind this, that they can attack at will at any time, a time of their choosing. And that would suggest that Belgium is a center of ISIS and Islamist radicalism in Europe.
I wouldn't be too quick with those assumptions, because it creates perhaps also a picture which makes it too easy for others to evade responsibility. I think it's in the center of Europe, it's in the center of the Western liberal societies that we have such a problem and such an attack. And we need to stand together now. We need to approach this and not give in to it. And face those who try to get rid of our foundations. So that's the moment where we need to really stand together and stand for our values and say clearly that we won't give in to those terrorists, and that they may not just threaten us, but that we may and should be better to just get our laws enforced and get these people locked down as soon as possible.
Jean-Philippe Albrecht is member of the European Parliament and vice chair of the Civil Liberties and Home Affairs Committee. He spoke with us from Brussels in the European Parliament building, just a few hundred meters from the bombing in the Central Railway Station. Jan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What does this attack mean? Is this attack something that would have required a lot of longstanding planning, or was it an off-the-shelf attack by ISIS that they would carry out at will? ISIS has now claimed responsibility for the bombs that killed more than two dozen and wounded 150 more. Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel has called for solidarity, stating that the world must stand together against terrorists. But is Belgium a special case of vulnerability because of geography or because they have allowed security to be degraded over time in some way? I'm joined by Jack Berger, the research analyst at the Sufan Group. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Is Belgium a special case?
Well, Belgium, as well as Paris, is a special case just because of the amount of foreign fighters that have traveled to Syria. Belgium has the highest per capita number of foreign fighters that have traveled to Syria. And it also has these neighborhoods where there's a high concentration of foreign fighters. Four of the attackers in Paris actually came from the same neighborhood, including Salah Abdeslam, who was captured last Friday.
And there was some talk by investigators that they were expecting a retaliatory strike, which leads me to believe that this is not just a neighborhood with some bad folks. This is an organized base inside of Belgium.
Well, the thing that you see with these kinds of terror networks is a lot of it is community-based. It's familial even. And so the problem with that is that it makes it very hard to track, and it also means that it can spread very quickly because it's person-to-person contact, which is much more influential on these people than being influenced over the internet, for example, being radicalized over the internet. And so neighborhoods like Molenbeek in Belgium is a special case because you have those familial ties, which makes it harder to intercept, makes it harder to stop the spread of radicalization.
So what do you do in that case? I mean, if it is the case that this arrest took place of Abdeslam, and then somebody went to work on the phone and said, okay, execute plan B. That means six people go to the airport strapped with explosives, four people to the railway station strapped with explosives. I mean, that's not a case of radicalization. That's a case of we're ready to go.
Right. And the problem is that we don't know exactly what the impetus for this attack was. We don't know whether it was retaliatory as revenge for the capture and the killing of another man, Mohammed Belkaid, who was in the apartment with Abdeslam, or whether this was a separate cell. They were being segmented from one another, and the order came from outside because they were afraid that Abdeslam would, in fact, cooperate with authorities. So in terms of how you respond, really all you can do is try to make sure that any of these leads, because, again, it's not that these suspects are unknown to authorities. It's simply that they have trouble tracking them down because they can dig into these neighborhoods. And so really working with the communities, really community-oriented policing and that kind of thing is really one of the best options for making sure that they can't stay within these communities for so long.
Although I'd be very dubious of Molenbeek's loyalty to Belgian authorities. I mean, who are you going to talk to? If it's that concentrated.
Sure. And it's always hard to question loyalty. You don't want to, dismiss a neighborhood as being traitorous to the nation. But certainly, even when Abdeslam was captured, there were some who were celebrating the capture, but there were also some who were actively protesting. Abdeslam was shot. Belkaid was killed. And they were protesting, as we see in the U.S., police brutality. They felt that police interrogation tactics and raid tactics had been too brutal in the past, especially after the Paris attacks.
Jack, I want you to listen to this.
Sure.
We talked with Samuel Laurent, who's a Middle East analyst who's done a lot of work in London. And you're familiar with the descriptions of Somalia and Libya as places of a level of instability that means that ISIS and al-Qaeda essentially can operate freely there. Yemen is another example. Listen to this comparison he made on our program this morning.
Belgium has several factors that make it a highly vulnerable target. The first one is that this is a very weak politically speaking country. There has been undergoing major crisis in 2007-2010. It has weakened the security apparatus, the intelligence services, and therefore, to a much lesser extent, this is the same pattern than the one we saw in Libya, in Somalia, and in all those countries. So basically, it has become a hotbed for radical Islam.
I mean, he's saying in the shadow of the EU governance institutions, Belgium essentially amounts to a European failed state hotbed of Islamic radicalism.
I can't speak as much to the political crisis in Belgium, but you do look at a place like France and the Paris attacks happened twice last year, where we don't consider France to be a failed state. However, they do have certain social issues that drive radicalization factors.
And people involved in the Paris attacks came from Belgium.
Yes, it was partly planned in Belgium. However, they still managed to hide out. Some of them were French nationals, so that the process started in France, and they certainly chose France for a reason.
I mean, the opportunistic level of development of a kind of terror infrastructure in Belgium really changes the game, it seems to me. I mean, I don't know what you do in the Molenbeek neighborhood. I mean, certainly the right wing, the Le Pens of the world, the Frege Petras of the world are going to be calling for, house to house expulsions.
Sure. And you certainly, even the Belgian authorities themselves have said that they're overwhelmed with the scale of the problem. So it means that they are asking for outside help. They're asking for more cooperation with European intelligence networks, especially those who are tracking fighters that are going back and forth from Syria. We've seen in the French case that that is something that is happening, that fighters are able to move back and forth and carry out these attacks and set up cells. But again, you have to be careful that it's a balance between how hard you come down on certain neighborhoods, because the more that you alienate communities, it makes it even harder to infiltrate or to detect these cells as they lie in wait and eventually are able to carry out these kinds of attacks.
Well, an extraordinary dilemma faced not only by Belgium but by all of Europe. If this is the level of operational capability that exists within Belgium demonstrated by this attack. Jack Berger is the research analyst at the Sufan Group. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Today, Major League Diplomacy plays ball to improve the relations of Cuba and the United States. Today, for the first time in more than 15 years, a U.S. Major League team, the Tampa Bay Rays, plays against the Cuban national team in Havana, Cuba, with both President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro in attendance. The game coincides with a new rule that would allow Major League Baseball to recruit and sign players openly. Players like Jose Contreras, Alexi Ramirez, Jose Abreu, all-star players, became millionaires after sneaking out of Cold War Cuba. And then there's the case of El Duque of the New York Yankees. About 7:30 on the morning after Christmas 1998, Orlando Hernandez, one of the best pitchers ever on the Cuban national baseball team, and seven companions got into a small sailboat with four oars. They loaded four cans of Spam, bread, sugar, and drinking water onto the craft and guided it into the waters off the Cuban coast. Their sailboat failed, and they were adrift for 10 hours, sinking when the U.S. Coast Guard rescued them. El Duque asked for political asylum and became a Yankee ace. Joe Kioski is a consultant and former sports agent who represented players who defected from Cuba. Today's demonstration game, he says, is more symbolic. There are not expected to be a lot of defections or contracts explored today.
Unlike the Orioles exhibition game in 1999, when the Cuban national team was chock full of Major League Baseball prospects, this team has been substantially weakened by defections and chock full of players who were big-time prospects a decade ago. But now, because of the passing of time, most of these players are probably looking across the field and thinking, that could have been me had I made a different life choice 10 years ago.
Raul Castro and Fidel before him, thought of baseball as a symbol of national pride, on par with the Olympic boxing back in the old days. Does this change by the Treasury Department change that sense of pride, or are the Cubans not really terribly happy about this change?
My understanding or my belief is it's the latter. After hundreds of defections, it's clear that Cuba lost the battle of trying to keep its best players in Cuba to play for national pride rather than for dollars in the big leagues in the United States. Cuba sort of being dragged along at this point in time, where they have no other choice but to acknowledge the reality of the situation, which is that there's basically nothing the Cuban government can do to keep the overwhelming majority of young players on the island, as was the case 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago, back when the average Cuban kid wanted to play for the Cuban national team in the Olympics rather than playing for the Yankees or the Dodgers or some other Major League Baseball team.
Given the amount of money that the Cuban defectors had at their disposal being dangled in front of them, especially when they were overt prospects, can anyone compete with the contracts, $100 million, $140 million?
It's incredible the extent to which the dollar amounts have risen in the Cuban defector market. 10, 15 years ago, it was still fairly uncommon for a Cuban player to sign even a seven-figure contract, let alone an eight-figure contract. Now we have relatively mediocre Cuban players signing for $50, $60, $70 million. The really interesting thing to me is the number of players who allowed those dollar amounts to be offered and allowed their prospect years to basically be wasted away. The team playing the Tampa Bay Rays is full of players who could have signed multi-million dollar contracts, but instead they chose to stay in Cuba for one reason or another, whether it was pride or fear, family issues. But there's probably $50 or $100 million worth of players on the field for Cuba in this game in lost money. Money that could have been paid out in signing bonuses and contracts had those players left in their prime rather than remain in Cuba.
Joe Kiyoski is a consultant and former sports agent speaking about the future of Cuban baseball in the wake of this fabulous and historic game that's being played as part of the Obama visit to Cuba. Joe, thanks so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
The national nail-biter that the Republican race for the presidential nomination has become has made each state contest its own gripping drama, even in states that have never been seen as keys to the nomination. Utah and Arizona are the latest primaries to boost the tallies of the three remaining candidates, one of whom, John Kasich, seems to be counting on a contested convention. Ted Cruz, who is trying to catch up to Donald Trump's delegate count and is running strong in Utah especially. But at the very least, we get to hear the subtle, nuanced way in which Donald Trump uses his unmatched rhetorical skills to attract Utah's Mormons.
Do I love the Mormons, okay? Do I love the Mormons? I have many friends that live in Salt Lake. I have a lot of friends. No, I have a lot of friends. By the way, Mitt Romney is not one of them. Did he choke? Did this guy choke? He's a choke artist. I can't believe. Are you sure he's a Mormon? Are we sure?
Donald Trump on a campaign swing in Salt Lake City last Friday. Bill Allred is a co-host of the Radio From Hell show on KXRK in Salt Lake City. He says that Trump came off sounding more like a visitor from Sodom and Gomorrah, which didn't exactly appeal to the family values suburbs surrounding Salt Lake City.
I think to the general Mormon population, they sort of weren't fooled. You know, it was like Donald Trump getting out the sorting hat from Harry Potter and, they say, let's see if we can figure out who's a Mormon and who's not a Mormon. But he likes the Mormons. You know, he wants to make that very clear. And then he had his son call up and say, please, please give my dad another chance. He's more like you Mormons than you know. He doesn't drink and he doesn't smoke and he never has any. And he's had several wives.
Did he really say that?
Well, I don't think he said the several wives. No, but he did say he doesn't drink and he doesn't smoke. And he has had several wives, but just not all at the same time.
Right. So he did it the normal sort of Protestant way to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when Mitt Romney was running, you never heard Mormon-ness really talked about. It was as though there was a kind of be discreet, Mitt. Don't, wave some Mormon flag here. We want you to win. But now it seems like, Ted Cruz is coming to town and it's Mormon this and Mormon that. And look at me. And I'm practically Brigham Young. And what's changed? I mean, it seems like now it's like out of the closet, marching down the street.
Well, what's changed is those delegates. Ted Cruz really, 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 really wants those delegates. And Donald Trump really, really, really wants those delegates. There are, 36, 40 delegates? I think there are 40 Republican delegates, and they really want them. That's it.
What about on the Democratic side? Bernie's doing doing well in Utah. Is that a kind of a sign of Trump disgruntlement with the two-party system on the left?
I think Utahns, the Democrats, would rather vote for a socialist than they would rather vote for a woman. I mean,
wow.
Theoretically, Bernie Sanders could be a priesthood holder. he And Hillary Clinton can't be a priesthood holder.
So. Well, I'll tell you, in the history of modern American politics, I don't think it's ever been the case that a candidate, you know, decided not to speak to AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, at their big event, and instead flew out to Utah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And again, it's those. I think Bernie Sanders really wants those delegates that are in play.
Just around the state, is everybody taking this seriously? Is everybody really thrilled with all the attention that Utah is getting?
You know, it's hard to gauge. I'm here in Salt Lake City, and that seems to be where, you know, everything happens. But you go outside of Salt Lake City, and it is a different world. It's very conservative once you leave Salt Lake. Salt Lake City, we have an openly a gay mayor here. And Salt Lake is pretty liberal, and then but you go outside of Salt Lake City, you go south, and you go a little bit north, and it becomes very conservative. And so I think they like Ted Cruz. When Ted Cruz and you know his buddy Mike Lee, our senator Mike Lee, they were the two guys who brought the federal government to a standstill a couple of years ago, and they're still great pals. And Ted Cruz was here campaigning for Mike Lee to be reelected in his bid to get reelected to the Senate.
Bill Allred, the co-host of the Radio From Hell show on KXRK. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you.
Can you imagine a place where being a heroin addict is not a stigma, where you're surrounded by supportive former addicts and counselors and abundant care, where insurance is available, and even voices on the radio are reaching out to you as well?
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the Triple R. This is Recovery Radio Raw on CVU Radio 95.9, 106.9 FM and AM 960. And we are a 12-step recovery talk show.
Welcome to Delray Beach, Florida, the so-called drug recovery capital of the United States. An oasis of sobriety, it was called by the New York Times back in 2007. A town full of helping hands and halfway houses. 2007 is when then-addict Franklin Holmes came to Delray, eventually starting his own Rehab Intervention Foundation. But there is a dark side to Delray Beach. In the last 9 years, a trading in addicts and insurance clients and even urine to funnel money into unscrupulous rehab programs has grown up that takes people in, sobers them up, and then after they're back on the street, gets them high and starts the cycle all over again. It's worth millions of dollars. There have been allegations of sexual abuse, victimization of hundreds, if not thousands, of heroin addicts who have simply sought help in the town. Franklin Holmes watched it all happen.
I first came to Delray Beach in 2007, and I thought I was ready to quit using at the time, and I wasn't. I came back 2012, and I actually was ready, and I was done. And at that time, I didn't have any insurance, and my family didn't have money to send me to treatment. I called over 40 treatment centers down in South Florida alone. And once I told them I didn't have money or insurance, you know, they'd give me a 1-800 number, you know, kind of just try to push me off the phone. Well, when I got down here, I was really desperate to stay sober, and I did what I needed to do. I met up with good people, started getting into 12-step programs. When I hit about a year sober, I started noticing, you know, I started wanting to get involved in helping others and working in the field. And I started noticing, you know, these marketers that were like sitting outside of Starbucks or Spot Coffee, you would see a kid come by with a backpack and, you know, they'd be frustrated. And, you know, you just talk to them, ask how they're doing. And all of a sudden three kids would run up and be like, oh, man, where'd you get kicked out of? What do you want? Do you need more? You know, what kind of insurance do you got? And it's like, you know, not how are you doing? How are you okay? And I started seeing that. And then I started hearing how much money was being made off of these people. It literally like angered me to the point of wanting to fight these marketers.
And you take a really ideological approach here. I mean, the name of your foundation couldn't be more blunt. It's sort of the F word heroin foundation. And you're committed to treatment. Do you get reimbursement? Are you in the same sort of social services matrix as some of these other groups?
I mean, obviously we're paid for what we do. However, we're not paid per client. We actually work directly for a treatment center and do everything from, my mom's actually a licensed chemical dependency counselor out of Ohio. And then she's also a life coach down here in Florida. So what we do is, instead of just, you know, dumping people off at treatment centers, which is generally what happens down here, is we're actually at our treatment center for anywhere from 6 to 12 hours a day, talking with our clients, spending time with them, rebuilding their families, setting them up for vocational training, you know, things like that, instead of just getting people on the phone and dumping them in a treatment center and never speaking to them again. You know,
well, this
I mean?
BuzzFeed article that turned us on to what you're doing also profiles this really sad case of Jessica Bostick, who was an addict who was really targeted by scammers, who found herself completely caught up in this entire scam, bounced around from rehab facility to rehab facility, possibly sold into the sex trade, and then given heroin to get high, and then is sent back to a rehab facility. And, you know, the cycle just keeps going almost indefinitely, and you managed to intervene.
Yes, sir. Well, she came down here with us at first originally, and then, you know, she kind of strayed away. And then when she got a hold of us again, that's when, you know, we were like, look, this is serious out here. And she started seeing what was happening. And then she, you know, she was like, well, what do I need to do? And at that point, you know, we were able to get her into a decent place. Now she's doing really well. And, you know, the thing that makes me really happy is, you know, when people get out of a really bad situation and learn how to overcome it, like addiction itself, you know, it says in the big book of AA, we're like members of a ship after a wreck. Once we're all safe together, we want to reminisce about that and tell other people how we survived that. And, you know, that's something I see her doing now, not just with her addiction, but, you know, with these corrupt sober livings and treatment centers.
Well, I admire what you've done. Before we go, I want you to give us a sense again in some more detail, because there's a couple of things that we haven't covered here that, again, are just really mind-blowing, how medicine itself is used against these people. For instance, urine tests are kind of the coin of the realm. I mean, they're the currency whereby you cycle people in. How does that work?
I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that a cup of urine is worth anywhere from $1,500 to $3,500. And the sick thing about it is, you know, what was happening and what still is happening to these day is treatment centers, they'll get to the point where they've billed everything else that they can on insurance. So then all they have left is urine. So they'll give somebody 7 urine tests a week, which is completely uncalled for. You know, with opiates, you know, you could be tested every 3 to 5 days and you're going to get the same results as you would every single day. But they'll do this and they'll try to charge the maximum amount.
The labs pay for this under insurance, right?
Yeah, I mean, and insurance isn't always going to pay the full amount. But still, even if they're paying 25% of that $3,500 for 90 people, I mean, you could imagine what these places are making just off of urine in a week. You know, it's disgusting.
Franklin Holmes is a former heroin addict in Delray Beach, Florida, and he's founder of a foundation that attempts to intervene to give responsible care to heroin addicts seeking treatment. Franklin, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's end came when he was hung in a chaotic execution that showed a calm-to-the-end tyrant being taunted by his revenge-crazed executioners, his body brutalized and desecrated and videotaped for the world to see. The main character in Kenan Makiya's novel The Rope ends up holding that hangman's rope, which was chopped up and sold as trophies. And through an Iraqi's eyes, the deep sickness and damage to his homeland from years of dictatorship and war was suddenly unveiled. This story of Iraq, told by Kenan Makiya, a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University, is a novel of people in the shadows of occupiers, warlords, green zones, and sectarian neighborhoods, defeated by their own history and an inability to escape it. Makiya was at one time a supporter of the American invasion and an advisor to the interim governing council, and he writes this fictional account drawing on his experiences from that time between 2003 and 2006.
The narrator is a young militiaman, Shiite militiaman, who very quickly after 2003 joins the Mahdi Army, which is the militia that was set up by Muqtada Sadr, who is even today very prominent in the news. But back then, he started a militia very much in his father's image, called the Mahdi Army. The Mahdi is the Shiite Messiah, and there is a significance to that name.
So you describe at one point in this book, and I think it begins to sort of set the tone for how many different points of view there are in Iraq now. There are Iraqis like us, Haider said, and in Baghdad there are foreigner Iraqis. What do you mean, I asked, intrigued. They hate Saddam differently. And then you describe just how different the foreigner Iraqis are from the people who stayed and endured Saddam and the invasion. How do you see that today?
Well, those foreigner Iraqis are quite entrenched, those of them who entered government and who, until today, play very prominent positions. And they include exiles, effectively, people who had exiled from as long as 30 years to those who had been exiled 10 years. And myself included, is I would be a typical example of a foreigner Iraqi, except that I never entered government in any way, shape, or form.
And the way you describe them, of course, we in the United States were heard that they were going to be welcomed back, but they had almost no credibility.
Well, they had no credibility, and they brought it upon themselves, those of them who entered politics. And by those, primarily, I mean the 13 out of 25 in the governing council chosen by the Americans. But that having been said, this is not a novel about American failure. It's an Iraqi story of 2003. We know a lot about all the things that went wrong from the American side of things. But in some sense, I think the far more important story and the far bigger failure in historical terms is an Iraqi one. And that's what this novel is about.
The opening scene in this book is the hanging of Saddam Hussein. And the title of this book comes from the rope that was used to hang him, a rope that became something of a talisman that was valuable right. If you had a piece of it. And you describe that experience as being exciting, wondrous, and then ultimately horribly disillusioning.
Sordid, yeah.
How could the tyrant, as you describe him, be both a unifying principle for Iraqis and then something that the absence of which produces such chaos?
That's a really good question. Of course, I open with that scene that you just described, because it's the scene that reveals the rot that had been accumulating for a number of years before that. Remember, that hanging was caught on some imbecile's smartphone and broadcast all over the world. So we saw the sordidness of the hanging. We saw what a tawdry affair it was. Now, did it have to be that way is a question. But the tyrant's influence is still there. In the teeth of his death, he is victorious, so to speak, in Iraq. That, I think, is the moral of the book.
You know, there is a sense in which that history needs to be told. I'm curious as to why you chose a novel to tell this story. Much of it is true in the sense that there are lots of true facts and events that you rely on that you witnessed yourself. But nevertheless, this is fiction.
True. I saw this as a subjective failure, a failure of individuals, of character, of judgments. In order to understand it, you had to look into jealousies that went back decades, if not centuries, in an extremely conservative, closed-off-to-the-world city like Najaf. You had to know the houses of Shiism and their historic feudings that culminated in the murder that also plays a very important role in this book. So how do you touch all of that when none of it is, so to speak, documented? I was there the whole of 2003 to 2006, and I knew these characters. And I wanted to focus on that subjective element, that failure of character, and I thought fiction would help me better do that. And I had some names to protect.
And this is what brings me to Camus. I mean, in many ways, he is a novelist innovator by telling a story from a point of view that no European had been able to create in the character, in The Plague, for instance. And here, you're doing the same. You're really giving us an Arab perspective of a dissolution that is almost, it seems like magical realism. It's so deep. Do you sense that you're taking a page from those existentialist authors of the 20th century in trying to convey this madness of Iraq?
It's not a coincidence that Camus must be my favorite writer of the post-World War II period. So you've managed to see that through the novel. The other favorite writer, of course, who's relevant here, is Dostoevsky, because of the demonic power that he was able to see in ideas when they're unleashed upon societies in certain moments, crucial moments of their history. That demonic power of ideas is also something I touch upon. You know, we talk about Shiites and Sunnites today as though these are established identities that go back centuries. But what we're looking at here in Iraq are quickly cobbled together identities in the name of those ancient identities. Shiites in Iraq especially feel themselves to be eternal victims. But unlike in Iran, where Shiism came from the top down and a majority of Shiites have never not been in power, so to speak, in Iraq they have never exercised power. And their victimhood is deeply instilled in their sense of who they are. Now, here again, there was a hope, call it an illusion, some would say, of a person like myself, who's also Shiite, incidentally, who was saying one could arise above that deeply instilled sense of victimhood. And I was, of course, wrong. That is, I still think it's in principle doable, but you need very exceptional men to do it. And that we did not have.
Well, if you wish to explore from the safety of a novel those deeply uncharted waters, I highly recommend the novel The Rope. Kanan Makia is the author of The Rope and professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University. Kanan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Deadly Identities, a Place of Chaos, story of Iraq. We move to Brussels, where dozens are dead, many more wounded after explosions hit the main international terminal and a metro station. Belgium's capital airport and metro system are closed. No flights entering or leaving the city until at least 6 a.m. tomorrow. And that's choking off traffic all across Europe and the world. City officials have raised the national terror level to its highest level since the Paris terror attacks last November. All these attacks followed the arrest of Salah Abdussalam, one of the surviving members of the Paris attack team. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.